Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey guys, welcome to episode 192 of The True Crime Couple. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope that all is well and want you to know that we are lucky to get to bring you another episode. We appreciate all you do as listeners. Even just being here listening to us helps the podcast tremendously. If you've recently joined Patreon, please stay tuned at the end so you can hear a shout out. Okay, well, now that all that is out of the way, let's get started with the podcast. John, are you ready to hear something crazy?
Yes. Really quickly, though, I am stuffy. So just be prepared for that.
You got a little bit of a cold.
I do.
And you have to stay far away from me.
I'm trying. But
you
I am ready.
Don't sound stuffy, so you're okay. Don't worry.
You know what? People say that. Every time I say I'm stuffy, they're like, no, you're not. But trust me, I feel it.
You'll be fine.
But I'm prepared. I'm ready.
You'll get through. This is worth it.
Okay.
In today's case, we're going to head back to Gunnison, Colorado. But when we were last there at the 7-Eleven Ranch, it was 2018. For this episode, we're going to go back another 31 years to 1989. It was then that a young Gunnison County investigator was given the task of tackling the county's cold cases. The woman, Kathy Young, was hell-bent on breaking records in Gunnison. She had been one of the first female officers in the county, and she was, on top of her regular caseload, determined to solve the case of Michelle Wallace, the only unsolved murder in the county. And she would do more than that.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
25-year-old Michelle Wallace had been born in Forest Park, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. From a very young age, her adventurous spirit was something that left her family in awe. She was never like the other girls around her. She didn't want to play with dolls or dress up. She much rather preferred spending time with her brother and his friends. She was also very active and got out in nature whenever she could. Michelle's was a spirit that could not be contained. So after graduating from high school in 1967, she chose to take some time off and visit Africa and Spain. When she returned from her trip, she attended Utah State University, but left after only completing 2 years. She next moved to Aspen, Colorado, where she loved the views of the Rockies and skiing. It was there that she fell in love with photography and decided to do it full time. She had obtained a job as a highway maintenance worker, so she could take photographs while she worked of the mountainscapes that surrounded her. Michelle planned on using the summer of 1974 to capture all there was to see in the Rocky Mountains, because that fall, she would start a new phase of her life as she was to begin her dream job in North Carolina as a photographer for a world-renowned magazine. Back in her hometown, Michelle had her mother, Margaret, and her father, George, who were living vicariously through their fearless daughter. And at her side, she had her trusty German shepherd, Oki, who had been her partner in crime, accompanying her throughout all of her life's journeys. Unfortunately, there was someone else in the mountains that summer. Someone who had horrible intentions for Michelle. According to the cold case file that Kathy Young reviewed, Michelle had disappeared without a trace on August 30th, 1974. Michelle Wallace was described as many things: a tomboy, laid back, cool, a flower child, but she had her wits about her. Not only was she well-traveled, but she knew the area well, as she had called West Gunnison home for quite some time at that point. She was not a stranger to the trails that she was on, nor was Oki, her loyal and fiercely protective companion.
What kind of dog was it?
A German Shepherd. A black German Shepherd.
Nice. Okay.
So, I mean, that's good. She's a woman by herself going hiking on these trails. And it was nice to have the dog with her.
Oh, absolutely.
Not just people, but animals are out there. So Oki was very intimidating. So often, you know, Michelle never really ran into any trouble.
I mean, it's good that she at least had some kind of like support.
Protection,
so to speak.
Support, sidekick. Yeah.
Sidekick, yeah.
And it's a good thing that she had Oki, because Michelle may have been all of those things that all the others called her, but she was also stunningly and effortlessly gorgeous. Her backpacking on her own could have been very dangerous, but what gave her comfort was the dog. So Young believed, just as the other detectives we have covered who researched cold cases, that the answer to the mystery was in the file. It had to be. Whether it was an overlooked detail or a suspect they just couldn't get, she knew the answer was in there. So she pored over every document that cardboard box contained. And the following was the story that she read. Michelle set off on her backpacking trip on August 27th, 1974. She told her family and friends that she would be gone for 4 days. And that she would be driving and hiking Schofield Pass, which is located 30 miles north of Gunnison near Grand Junction. If you have time, I suggest you look the pass up. The views are truly insane. Crystal clear water surrounded by sloped greenery that meets a perfectly blue sky. It's paradise for a nature photographer. But it is also a very difficult road, with narrow, steep passages, not for the inexperienced or the faint of heart, both of which Michelle was not. On September 1st, 5 days after she left, her family believed that something was wrong, especially her mother, Margaret. Michelle always called her mother every week to check in, so she knew that she was okay and to update her on her life. However, that Sunday came and went, and no call was received. No matter where Michelle was in the world, she always called once a week, and she would make her plans surrounding the fact that she would always need to be home on Sunday to call her parents. This was a huge indicator that something was seriously wrong.
Definitely. I mean, because I think that she has never shown any other way about her, right? I mean, this is something that, you know, it's consistency. You know, this is a woman that has gone to different countries. She's been all over the place. This isn't like someone's first attempt at like going on their own and it's all kind of unknown. She kind of seems to be very, she likes the routine of things.
Yes.
So it's out of the ordinary and it's definitely a small red flag.
And you know, her parents are great with her traveling. I mean, they want her to experience the world. They're so excited that she has this adventurous spirit that they kind of didn't have themselves. But their one rule was like, you have to keep in touch with us so we know you're safe because you're traveling by yourself.
Also, let's just add that this is also 1974. So like, this is obviously the, you know, the time before cell phones. So you would have to definitely make time to find some kind of phone to use, whether it be a hotel, a restaurant, anything. Like, and wherever you were, you'd have to make it work. You'd have to know.
You can't just use a cell phone or have your location tracked.
Right. It's so totally it's almost like making sure that you have an extra event on the schedule because you need to be somewhere for that.
Correct. So Margaret called her daughter's friend to see if she had heard from her. She had not, but suggested that maybe she wait one more day because she knew it was a long trail and it was difficult. So if they still hadn't heard from Michelle, they would call the police then. When the following day came and went and they didn't hear from her, they did just that. The Gunnison police, used to dealing with missing persons cases around the trails and passes, issued an APB and began to organize a search party as soon as the report was filed. Their fear was that she was injured along the trail somewhere. And this was during a time like the end of August, so things are really hot. So they want to make sure that if she's injured and stuck somewhere on the trail that they get to her so she doesn't die of dehydration or blood loss. So they make this an emergency right away.
Oh, absolutely. A quick question, though. This was this a trail within a national park?
No.
Okay, okay. Because we know what happens in national parks.
National parks are highly questionable.
Kind of strange, but okay. Just clarifying whether it was just a trail or like a trail within.
Just a trail through the Rockies.
Because I feel like that does change things a little bit.
I mean, it does join with other trails, so it's very interconnected, but not truly a national park.
Gotcha.
Michelle's family rushed to the area to aid in the investigation. After weeks of searching and thousands of miles having been covered, investigators had nothing to show for their efforts. The only clue that they had was another tragedy. So I'm just going to give a warning here. It deals with an animal being injured. So if that's something you don't want to hear, you could fast forward 30 to 45 seconds. Oki had run down from the mountain and onto the property of a rancher. The rancher had called law enforcement to report that he had shot a dog that had been harassing his livestock. This occurred on September 5th, 1 week after she had been reported missing. So it seemed that the dog might have been hungry and was harassing animals.
Okay.
So unfortunately, this is just another tragedy for the family because Oki was a member of their family too.
Right. And it also makes you question now, why is Oki kind of running around on its own without, right. you know, without their owner.
Right.
Which means that something might have happened.
Well, yeah. And according to Margaret, Oki never left Michelle's side. So if he had run from the mountain, that meant that Michelle was in trouble or was no longer there. So to her family, this wasn't a good sign. But to investigators, they actually saw this as a good sign because it meant that Michelle had not left the mountain and that she was there because she never would have left her dog behind just on a trail.
I mean, but at this time, they just think she's missing. They don't think that there could be possible foul play, though, do they?
They don't think there could be possible foul play, but they do think it's possible for an adult woman to just say, hey, I kind of want to like leave my life.
I see.
So they're saying, well, that's not what happened here if her dog was left behind.
Gotcha.
She would have taken her dog with her if she just chose to leave her life.
Right.
On a daily basis, search parties of professional search and rescue teams were organized, and they were coming back with nothing. And it was really important that this isn't just terrain that local volunteers can go on. So it took a lot to organize these search parties because you had to have professional search and rescue teams who could search in such difficult areas. And because this was such a massive effort, the local media's interest was piqued. On the same day in which Oki had been found, Michelle's family gave many interviews in which they pleaded for the return of their daughter. Law enforcement requested information from locals. They wanted people to come forward with any information they may have, as innocuous as they think it may seem. The media attention worked. The following day, on September 6th, the sheriff's department received a phone call from a man named Chuck Matthews. Matthews, who was a ranch handyman, stated that he had seen a picture of Michelle on the news while he was at a bar, and he knew that he had run into her recently. He explained that he had been at the same bar that he had seen the news report at on August 30th. About a week prior, and 4 days after Michelle would have left for her hike. While he was there on that date, he met a ranch hand who introduced himself as Roy. While they were drinking, Roy had complained that there was a bear in the mountains and that it had been bothering him and his herd, and he had had enough. He said that he would go up into the mountains himself and shoot the bear, but he didn't have a vehicle to get up there. So he was stuck. Matthews told him that he had a car and he would be willing to drive to Schofield Pass and help him. Roy happily accepted. Both men traveled up into the pass and searched for the bear that Roy had been complaining about. But as they were traveling and waiting for this bear, the car that they were in had broken down. The two men pushed the car to the side of the road. They were essentially stranded. That is until Michelle Wallace came driving along the same road. Michelle, who had just finished her four-day hike, was headed home. And it was perfect timing because it was just a few days before Sunday when she would have to call her mother, just as she had planned. She stopped and asked the men if they needed help, because that was the kind of person she was. According to Matthews, Michelle drove them back into town, right by the bar. Matthews said that he got out of the back seat where he had been sitting with Oki, and he expected Roy to get out as well. But instead, Roy stayed in the vehicle with Michelle. Matthews heard Roy ask Michelle if she actually wouldn't mind giving him a ride to his truck. Well, this confused Matthews because he had been under the impression that Roy didn't have a vehicle, because that's what he told him. Remember, he said, "I can't go looking for the bear because I don't have a vehicle." So he just was very confused by the entire situation, because why the heck was his car up there broken down on the pass now?
Right. If you had a car, then you could have just done it yourself.
Right.
Instead of getting him involved. That's odd.
Yeah. So he really didn't know what Roy was playing at. Michelle was obviously beautiful. He was thinking, okay, maybe I misheard Roy, or maybe he just wants to spend more time with her because he finds her attractive. Either way, he just kind of shrugged off the whole scenario and chalked it up to a misunderstanding, because why would somebody lie about something like that? And he said goodbye to the two of them, and he went back into the bar. And he hadn't thought about the interaction since, until he saw Michelle's picture in the news.
I mean, that is a very interesting interaction, right? Because you have someone that has such a vivid recollection of that scenario, and he even thought it was odd. That's how you know that something's not right. When you have a dude that is right outside a bar and is like, "Hey, man, come on, let's go have drinks." And then you're just looking at the guy and he's just staying in there. Like, it's beyond, it's like, "Hey, let me shoot my shot and see if I can get with this woman."
Yeah.
Like, it's more than that. It's creepy. And when another dude can pick up on that, you know something's wrong.
Yeah, and Chuck Matthews definitely felt guilty after that interaction had happened. And he felt like maybe he should have said something, but...
I mean, what are you to do?
Right.
Right? I mean, that is an awkward situation to begin with. And honestly, if he also realized that and thought the situation was weird outside the vehicle, imagine Michelle in the vehicle. She probably felt the same way. Like, well, this is weird.
She wanted to help. And remember, this is 1974, and you're talking about an area like Colorado, where you are going to have to drive long distances in order to get to your location. So something like hitchhiking and ride sharing was something that happened all the time and wasn't weird. Like, that's something that we would consider odd today, because we have services like Uber and, you know, things like that. But back then it was kind of like, "Yeah, I'll help you out." And
well,
that was the mentality that she had, because she was such a helpful, nice person.
You're on the right track. But if we really look at that, if you think about it, from then to now, it really hasn't changed. Because if you think about it, when you request your Uber or your other whatever provider you use,
yes,
you really have to think about it. That person's a stranger to you. You have no idea. You're getting into a stranger's car. It's actually paid hitchhiking.
No, it is. And it's, you know, someone could say who they are, but it doesn't mean they can't not hurt you. It is really kind of creepy when you think
or
about it.
How about, right, exactly. Like, it's actually worse now. And then there's times like, I don't know about you, but I've used Uber a couple times when I needed to.
Yeah.
And it's like, one day I requested some, like, you know, a ride, and the name did not match the person or the picture that came to pick me up.
Yeah. And that's, they're not allowed to do that.
They're not allowed to do that. And I was like, well,
I got
to
get in.
I'm like, I do have to go to this doctor's appointment. So I'm like, all right, well, you know, what am I going to do?
No, I know. It's kind of like, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah.
I've never taken an Uber alone. So, but I can imagine, knowing me, I would be terrified the whole entire time. Well, and you probably wouldn't let me do that.
No, I wouldn't let you do that. But anyway, to my point though, it's like the same thing, really.
Right.
Nowadays.
Okay. Well, before we get any further in the story, what I want to do is I want to take a break and talk about one of the sponsors that we have for today's show.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Okay, let's get back to the case. This was a very large break in the case because it changed everything. The Gunnison Sheriff's Department had been working under the theory that some kind of accident had befell Michelle while she had been hiking during her journey. But Matthew's story proved otherwise. She had finished her hike and was headed back into town. The last time she had been seen had not been the 27th, but the 30th. And the last person she had been seen with was this mysterious and highly questionable Roy character. This prompted the investigators back in 1974 to begin their search for Roy. They reached out to all the ranchers in the area, asking them if they knew anyone that went by the name of Roy as a ranch hand. They had. His name was Roy Melanson, but currently he was no longer in the area. About a week later, a man named Roy Melanson had been pulled over in a white Cadillac in Pueblo, Colorado, which is located about 160 miles away from Gunnison. There's a lot going on here. Apparently, Melanson had been accused of, well, he was, carrying on what they called in 1974 an affair, which is really statutory rape, predatory behavior, with the teenage daughter of one of his long-term friends.
Whoa.
Yes.
That's disgusting. What is wrong with
this guy? And when I say teenager, she's still in high school.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Melanson would often loiter around the school that this young girl attended, and he would often, allegedly, sell drugs to the kids there.
Stand-up citizen.
Well, unfortunately, the selling drugs thing was taken a little bit more seriously than the rape issue. And the Pueblo police responded to a call that two men were seen outside of the school, supposedly selling drugs to kids. When Melanson was pulled over there, he produced a Texas driver's license. The computer the officer had in his car malfunctioned, so both men were released. Hours later, when the computer was fixed, it revealed that Melanson was wanted for a 3-year-old rape case and possibly a suspect in the disappearance of a woman named Michelle Wallace. So okay. This rape case was back in Texas. This now he's wanted for questioning in the disappearance of Michelle.
But what we can determine already is that it kind of like this person kind of fits a possible suspect more than likely because he has a past and he's doing really messed up things currently.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's like a one-time off thing or like this person might have no involvement. This person has a track record.
Yeah, and it's not even though he's being accused of rape currently, they've been looking for him for 3 years. He had past rape cases as well.
Right. And we're also trying to maybe think like, okay, well, you know, I mean, Michelle Wallace was 25.
Yes.
You know, so like he's doing, I mean, I don't think it to someone like this, it probably doesn't matter how old they are, obviously.
No, it just seems he likes to wreak havoc.
Yeah.
The Pueblo police were able to pick Melanson back up once they realized, you know, the kind of person they had on their hands. And when they did, he again provided for them his Texas driver's license, his car's registration, keys, and in the car they found camping gear that could be seen out in the open when they had pulled him over. And this is something that interested them because Michelle Wallace had gone missing while hiking and she had had camping gear with her. So, I mean, it meant that he also had gone camping recently at some point and or this might not be his stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a good point, actually.
He also had with him upon further search of the vehicle, because at that point they had probable cause to search the car because of what can be seen in plain sight. They found a pawn ticket for a sleeping bag and camera equipment. Now, don't forget what Michelle was doing up in Schofield Pass.
Right.
Taking pictures.
And camping.
Mm-hmm. Melanson was brought in for questioning. Upon further search of his vehicle, there were other incriminating items found. Inside was Michelle's backpack, the registration for her red Mazda station wagon.
What?
And a key for a Mazda.
Okay, so this guy's just toting around all her belongings.
Yeah, and it's not over. When the police followed up with the pawn shop ticket, they found that the sleeping bag that was turned over had belonged to Michelle, as had the camera, a Canon F1. There were pictures on the camera of Oki, the landscape of Schofield Pass, and the last picture was a kind of like mirror picture that had been taken of Melanson laying on a bed, kind of like with his arm folded, hands behind his head, and his young victim, I refuse to call her his girlfriend, was on the bed next to him. So, yeah. He's giving them like evidence. He's like, hey, yeah, it was me. And if that isn't incriminating enough, I'm going to take a picture on the victim's camera.
I mean, that is wild, actually, when you really think about it.
Mm-hmm. So investigators in Pueblo contacted the Gunnison Sheriff's Department to let them know what they had found. When they questioned Melanson, he denied knowing anything about Michelle. They asked him if he had ever been in the missing 25-year-old's car, thinking about the story that Chuck Matthews had. His exact reply had been, "No, sir, I have never seen her in a vehicle, period." He refused to admit to anything, and it shocked the detectives how calm, cool, and collected he had been. He denied knowing Michelle completely. Then they brought up everything that they found in his vehicle. Now, this is when he finally broke down, in air quotes, and explained that he and this other man, he supposedly was talking about Chuck Matthews, the man that he had come across at a bar in Gunnison, the one who came forward to the police, he said that he and this other man had taken advantage of the young woman, referring to Michelle, that they had come across when their car broke down on Schofield Pass. He admitted that they had taken her things, but that was all. He ended it by saying, "Yes, this is bad, but we didn't hurt her, and the last time we saw her, she was alive and well."
So this guy's not even, I mean, this is wild, right? So in one breath, he's saying, "Oh, I never was even in a car with her, but yet we took advantage of her and took her things."
Yeah.
Well, come on, let's be real. There's no way that someone that's that passionate about their belongings and their camera and all those things, what, they're not going to do anything? They're just going to let you take it and you're just going to let them walk?
Right.
Obviously, more has happened here.
And then she just so happens to go missing after this.
Correct.
It doesn't add up. And while Melanson was being questioned, the other investigators were looking further into his history. And it was very troublesome. The man was born in Brobridge, Louisiana, in 1937, making him 37 and 22 years older than the girl that they're accusing, they're saying is his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Isn't that insane?
It is.
So he had been in and out of prison his whole life. In his teens and early 20s, he had 4 burglary charges against him from Orange, Texas, the last one being in 1960. At 24, 2 years later, he was arrested for rape. It seemed that the crimes escalated in violence the older Melanson became. His attack in 1962 had been a vicious one. So simple, right? Case solved. Unfortunately, it was not that easy. Of course, the detectives didn't believe him when he said he hadn't hurt Michelle. It had seemed obvious that he had. But it was 1974, and without a body or lack of more physical evidence, there was no way to charge him with anything except burglary. The fact that Michelle's attacker had seemingly been caught, but nothing could be done about it, destroyed the Wallace family, as did the unknown of what Melanson might have done to her and how she suffered at his hands. The pain of not having her daughter any longer and not knowing where she was or what had happened to her was too overwhelming for Margaret. And she died by suicide 5 weeks after she had reported Michelle missing.
Oh, man.
On October 9th, 1974.
That's so sad.
So sad.
But you know, it irritates me. It really does when I hear, like, when we hear things about, you know, everything points to one person. It seems to be like we're almost 90% sure that this is the person that is responsible for her disappearance and her murder, most likely. But we can't do anything. Well, right. Why is that? It's like, it's just one of those things. I understand you want to build a strong case. So trust me, I'm aware. But it's like, sometimes I feel like common sense is just not too common. Because if everything points to this guy, everything points to this guy, right? Like, okay, he literally it was in possession of her belongings and her car and the keys.
Correct. But that's all circumstantial evidence. And you don't want to run the risk of him possibly getting away with this and then not being able to be charged for it in the future.
I hear what you're saying.
It has to be beyond a reasonable doubt.
I know.
And a jury could very easily go the other way, especially because Melanson had gotten away with a lot in his life because he was a smooth talker. He knew what to say, how to say it, and when to say it.
I'm aware of all those things, and you are right. I guess
I love that's like music to my ears.
You are right. But for me, and I'm sure maybe there's others out there listening that feel the same way as me, this case is a little different because I understand the evidence is not there to put this guy away, but you have the eyewitness testimony of the guy that, and his memory of this is extremely vivid.
Right.
He remembers being up there for a bullshit cause and to begin with.
And said they didn't steal her things.
Right, exactly. And the guy didn't want to get out of her car and asked if she can take him to his truck that he didn't know that he had. Right. So there's a lie. There's an inconsistency. That right there, this guy's past is also extremely effed up.
Yeah.
And now he has her belongings. There is a lot there, guys. That makes me so angry. Because now you have this family tortured. It's bad enough that you have no idea where your child is.
Yeah.
It's even worse now that you are being tortured with it and it's being put in your face 24/7.
Right. But you're also talking about a society that wasn't oversaturated with true crime like we are today. And we understand that circumstantial evidence can point to murder. Whereas you're talking about a society that kind of didn't want to hear that stuff unless they had blatant evidence like a body.
You know what? I don't care if I was born in 1960 or in 1991. I'm sure that if I was a jury member, I would be like, no, this dude is 100% guilty.
And
I
don't need to be taken off the streets.
And I don't need to be proven of any other evidence to be presented to me to make that judgment call.
Well, I think that's why Michelle's family was so frustrated with the fact that Roy Melanson wasn't being charged with anything.
Yeah.
Because they knew in their hearts he did it. And they also knew that he was never going to give them the answers that they wanted.
That's so sad.
And Margaret's final wish that she had left for her devastated husband, George, was that when they did eventually find Michelle, and she hoped to God that they would, that she wanted George to promise that he would bury Michelle with her. And that was a promise that George would not soon forget. He and his son were now the only members of the Wallace family that remained.
That's devastating.
It's so hard for that family.
Oh.
Police knew that Melanson would not be in prison for long for the rape charge that he was facing in a different state or for the later burglary charge that he was being accused of for having Michelle's things. Desperate to make him pay for what he had done, various law enforcement offices in Colorado poured their resources into stopping him. But in order to do so, they would have to find Michelle's body. That's the key to this case. This was no easy task because of the terrain that existed in Gunnison. They had already searched and found nothing, so they were nervous again that they wouldn't be able to find anything. But they expanded the search. And over the next 4 months, the search for Michelle Wallace became the largest and longest search in the state's history. Over 5,000 man hours were spent searching 55 square miles of steep and rugged terrain that had never been searched before. However, the search had to be paused because of the approaching winter. Because Michelle had not been found, the Colorado authorities had to relent and extradite Melanson back to Texas to face the rape charge he had.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm glad that he's at least getting charged with something that he has to at least go in front
answer
of a
for.
Judge for. Yeah, sure. But I just don't understand how back in the day you could have a rap sheet a mile long and still be like somehow able to like post bail and get out.
Well, it's interesting you say that because back in Texas, once he has to go and face this rape charge, Roy Melanson was given a life sentence for the charge.
Oh.
Because he was a repeat offender. It had been his third accusation that he was found guilty of.
Wow. Okay. All right. I take it back.
And then they were incredibly violent. But you're not entirely wrong, John. So you would think that would be the end of the story, right? Roy Melanson did it, but was just never caught, but went to prison for something else. But that's not where this podcast will end. There's a lot more. In 1979, just about 5 years into Melanson's life sentence, there was a development in Michelle's case. A hiker had been traveling on Keebler Pass, which was located just south of Schofield Pass, located between the town of Gunnison and Schofield. And he had found a braid of human hair. 5 years prior, when Chuck Matthews had given his statement to the sheriff's department, he had described what Michelle had looked like, what she had been wearing, and how she styled her hair. He said that she had a braid in her long hair. The braid that had been found had a hair tie above and below it, so it managed to stay intact, and over the 5 years, and winter, and wind, and rain, never fell apart.
That's crazy.
Yes. Investigators thought that it might be related to the Michelle Wallace case, even though it occurred 5 years earlier. The technology had not been there in 1979, but they kept the braid in Michelle's case file, along with hairs that had been collected from a hairbrush from her apartment.
Okay, so they can compare it.
Luckily, well, not in 1979, they couldn't.
Well, that's right.
In 1974, they were smart enough to collect hairs from a hairbrush. And then in 1979, they just so happened to find this braid, but the technology wasn't there to test it. But when Kathy Young came upon this evidence in 1989, the technology was present.
That's so great. I love to hear that, right? The foresight to take evidence and to bag it, tag it, and put it away for future, investigation or use. Yeah. That's amazing. I love to hear that.
Because you never know what technology is going to be out there. So having the foresight and having good investigative procedures so early is good.
It definitely is.
100%. Sometimes we get accused of being a little pro-police. And I feel like when they need their criticism, we definitely give it to the police. But we can't say that they always do a bad job.
No, because, I mean, listen, we live in an imperfect world, right? I mean, people are going to make mistakes and then people are going to do the right thing. But I do like to hear
when they follow proper procedures. Correct,
because it needs to be done. That's how we find these things out. And in the future, when you think about it, like, they're already doing things now with genealogy. I know there's a lot of red tape there, but like, they're progressing at such a fast rate that all, 20, 30-year-old crimes now can really be like, they could solve it. So it's very good when people do the right thing.
Right. And I just think that this braid is going to be so important to the rest of the case. And I'm not going to give too much away, but you'll see why this braid is so important. And it's good that they even thought of Michelle Wallace's case in 1979. So now at this point, because Kathy Young couldn't just work on the Michelle Wallace case, she was doing it on top of her regular duties. So like when she had downtime was when she worked on this. So at this point, it's not 1989, it's 1991. So that's when she sends in this braid sample that she found in evidence to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation for testing. A few weeks later, she received the results. The braid found on Keebler Pass was a match for Michelle's hair.
Okay.
It was hers. Young thought that she had Melanson now. It was proof that something terrible happened to Michelle. And if they ever took it to trial, this is more than just circumstantial evidence. It showed that, like, the defense couldn't say, well, maybe she just decided to leave and start a new life without her hair.
When has that ever happened?
Yeah. It has. It does happen where people just choose to start a new life and they want to leave and,
Well, actually, I meant just to say, out of the cases that we have covered,
chop their hair off.
Yeah, like the case that we covered, it's very rare that I even hear that from you that that happens. The likelihood of that.
Well, then it wouldn't be a true crime podcast.
100%.
Yeah.
Like recently, I saw something. Speaking of, there was a guy that like faked his own death by like flipping over his like fishing boat.
Yes.
And they found him in Canada, but he like went through customs with his actual license or his passport. Well, so it was like, how, like, are you dumb?
No points for intelligence there.
Yeah. So I don't really know the you know, but that was just the gist of that. But like,
see, it does happen.
It does happen. But like, obviously with this, in these crimes, it's not going to be, we're not going to go talk about that. Like, you know what I mean? We haven't covered anything like that. And every time they say that, I always roll my eyes and go, no, dude.
Well, they always someone's say involved. It, they always say it about people who are completely happy in their lives and secure. And I think it's pretty obvious that she wouldn't just walk away from her life. She had her dream job coming up. She was very secure with her family.
And she was passionate.
Loved her career.
Right. She was passionate about her career. She would not have done that.
Right. She wouldn't have left her dog.
That's
There's
out of character.
A lot of factors.
Yeah. Here.
Well, Young called the Texas Department of Corrections because she wanted to speak with Melanson and see just what he would have to say about this new development. Maybe, because he was already serving a life sentence for those rapes, he would confess and put the Wallaces' minds at ease. And maybe they would get to bury Michelle with her mother so both women could finally be at peace. But Kathy Young was in for the shock of her life when she was informed by the Texas Department of Corrections that Roy Melanson had been released from his life sentence in prison.
You're kidding me.
Nope.
Why? How?
About a year prior, in March of 1988, he had been released from prison on a technicality.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew it.
His last rape charge had been overturned, meaning he did not commit three, meaning his life sentence did not need to be served because he wasn't a continued offender that had three strikes against him.
Are you looking to get me angry today? I do love you, but are you getting me angry today on purpose?
This is a hard one.
How are we going as a society going to say, all right, well, it's not three strikes, but he did it twice.
They know he did it the third time.
Okay.
But evidence was collected incorrectly, so it was a technicality that he got off.
I know. I still don't care. That's not.
I know.
It doesn't matter.
Well, our justice system is very frustrating at times.
Oh my God, it gets me so mad.
So Kathy Young was furious and scared. The fact that Melanson was released into the world with a new lease on life meant that women everywhere were in grave danger, and she couldn't have been more right. In 1991, states did not communicate as they did now. So when Melanson had been released, the surrounding jurisdictions had not been notified of his release.
Don't you think that that's foolish?
Yes. But we had, police departments not being in communication, not just because of technology, but sometimes it was a pissing contest that, you know, they wanted to take credit for certain things. And because of that, communication was just never truly established. So they're not going to communicate about other things like the release of a prisoner like Melanson. Okay, so now that we're mad, we're going to take a break and we are going to talk about our second sponsor of the show.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Okay, let's get back to the show. So we will never know truly if a warning would have prevented what I have to tell you next. But it sure would have at least assisted local law enforcement. On August 5th, 1988, Vince Lejeune came home to an empty house in Walker, Louisiana. This was something that he had not been expecting. Lejeune and his fiancée, Charlotte Sauerwin, always enjoyed the time they got to spend together when he would get home from his very difficult job of working on an oil rig. He figured that maybe she had just gone out and would be back shortly. Because of this, he decided to start cooking dinner himself. Two steaks, one for him, one for her. By 9 p.m., Lejeune began to worry. This was completely out of character for Charlotte. She would never be gone for so long and not have called or left a note. He worried that maybe she had been in an accident, so he called local hospitals to see if she had been admitted. She had not. But then he got an idea, and he finally relaxed. The couple had recently bought a plot of land on which they were going to build a home once they were married. Charlotte was known to drive out there from time to time and just sit and imagine the wonderful life they would share.
That's really cute.
That is adorable. And he thought maybe that's where she was.
Okay.
Vince Lejeune rushed out to the property to see if that's where Charlotte had gone. And maybe she had just lost track of time. He also knew that she really wanted the property cleared. So he was like, maybe she was doing it. And he was like, oh, that would be crazy. I hope she's not. So when he got there, he found her car off to the side of the road. But it looked like her car had been ransacked. And the driver's side door knob had been bent open like it was broken. He yelled for Charlotte and ran around desperately, but she was nowhere to be found. He drove back home and called the Livingston Parish Sheriff's Office to report Charlotte missing. The detectives and crime scene team got to the location just north of Walker at midnight. They saw that Charlotte's car had been ransacked, just as Lejeune had told them it was. Additional officers were called to the scene, and a search of the area commenced. Shortly thereafter, dogs were brought in to assist them. And it's with the canines that they made a devastating discovery. Charlotte was found at 2 a.m. on August 6th, buried face down beneath a large pile of brush. Later, the parish medical examiner's report would reveal all the suffering Charlotte had gone through in the last moments of her life. She had suffered a large stab wound to her neck, on top of being raped and manually strangled. The attack was brutal. She had been beaten badly in her face, and then a rope was placed around her neck, and she was dragged to the location where she was brutally raped and then finally stabbed, causing her death.
That is very brutal. Wow.
And this is on the property where she was supposed to build her home with her future husband.
Yeah.
And that's the most tragic thing I've ever heard.
I mean, it is. It's disgusting.
When the detectives informed Vince Lejeune, he was panicked and devastated. He seemed not to be able to comprehend what had happened. He wanted desperately to go to her, but the detectives told him that he couldn't go. They told him that he wouldn't want to see her that way, but a part of them suspected him.
The husband?
Well, it's always the husband, isn't it?
I know. You're right, actually. Especially on that property, no less. Mm-hmm. That is a very odd little breadcrumb.
Because who knows about that?
Unless this person was in the car with them and instructed her to drive there, maybe because they knew no one would be around.
Okay.
I don't know. That is odd.
Well, in the eyes of investigators, they're thinking, you know, how many people could know about this location?
Yeah.
It would later be her sister who would identify her at the morgue, not Vince Lejeune. The detectives of the parish were not used to investigating a crime so brutal and violent. Because of this, they needed more resources, so they asked for the assistance of the state police. The investigators believed that this was personal, because of how brutal the attack had been. Because of this, they wanted to look further into Charlotte's life. They learned that she was a beautiful, energetic, bubbly person. Everyone loved her. Charlotte had been so sweet. And what she loved more than anything was laying out in the sun and being able to spend time at the beach. And still, decades after his loss, Vince says he still cries over Charlotte. Because he had everything with her for a moment.
Yeah, that's very sad.
And then it was ripped away.
I mean, that guy's life's never the same again.
No, it was not. And we'll get a little further into that. When her family and friends were asked if anyone would have wanted to hurt her or if Charlotte had any problems going on in her life. They were told that no one would want to hurt her. But she did have a problem. She was obsessed with the property she had bought with Vince, in a good way, but obsessed with wanting to have it ready. The couple's plan had been to move onto the property in a trailer while their forever home was being built. But they couldn't even get the trailer onto the property until the land was cleared. And they added that Charlotte would share this information with anyone who would listen in hopes that maybe they knew someone who could get that work done for them. Next, the detectives went through Charlotte's day. On August 5th, the day she disappeared, she had gone to downtown Walker to do some laundry at the laundromat. The older couple that owned the establishment said that Charlotte was a regular and they knew her well. On that day, a man had been there using the facility. They said they were not aware of who he was. He'd never been there before, but he was really friendly. They had heard him talking with Charlotte about the property she owned with Vince. She said that they needed to clear the land and was anxious to get it done. This mystery man told Charlotte that he could clear the property no problem, that it was something that he could do. This mystery man told Charlotte that this was something he could do. He could clear the property no problem. He also told her that he wouldn't charge her too much. All she had to do was take him out there so he could give her an estimate. And they left the laundromat together.
So we're dealing with Roy then?
Potentially. I mean, there's a reason why I'm talking about it again.
Okay. This is crazy. Okay. But that would make sense as to how someone knows how to go there, right?
Right. This is how a stranger would know about the property if she took them out there, like you said.
It has to have been that way. Right. Unless someone did prior work there, but I don't think that was the case.
Well, what the people who were saying, the witnesses from the laundromat were saying, because this is a huge break in the case. So they want to talk to everyone who was there at the time. And it's not exactly as we thought, you thought that it went, that Charlotte drove someone there. This mystery man followed her in his own car. And they said that he was driving a light-colored car that had an out-of-state license plate, and they described him as being between 175 to 185 pounds, and he was about 5'11 or 6 feet tall, with a receding hairline. They said he was a smooth talker, and that while they were listening to him having a conversation with Charlotte, that he was easily able to disarm her. And I just wish that these people, like, if they knew Charlotte and she was a regular there, just, like, step in and be like, maybe this isn't a good idea. Like, maybe you should go with your husband with this guy later. You know, like, just, it's hard to interject in what's happening to other people. But this seems like a highly questionable situation.
But I think we're dealing with an age where most people were disarmed to the idea that someone random could work their way in and then kill you.
I know.
I feel like we only know that now because we are seasoned and oversaturated with...
Well, remember, this is 1988 now.
But still.
You're right.
Well, we are oversaturated with, podcasts and crime shows and documentaries. We are surrounded by it 24/7, so it's harder for us to gauge that.
Right.
You know?
Well, on August 9th, 3 days after her body had been found, a composite sketch of this man, the man that they had described, was released to the public. But beyond that, there were no leads. Now remember, these people know nothing about the release of Roy Melanson. And the detectives at the Livingston Parish began to think that this had to be something else. They seemed stuck on this being a personal crime, as did the people of Walker, Louisiana, which turned the investigators' attention and the court of public opinion in the direction of Vince Lejeune. Vince was questioned over and over again, and it was rare, he said, that he would come home from work and not find the detectives waiting for him in his driveway with more questions. He was clearly their person of interest. Charlotte's sister did not want to believe it was Vince, because she said that they had been so perfect together. However, she did know that Vince could have a temper. But could he have been capable of that? I mean, we're talking about a brutal crime. At the end of the day, most people in town believed Vince to be guilty, although there was no evidence against him. For years, everyone's accusing glances and whispers made Vince Lejeune's hometown of Walker, Louisiana, feel like he was in a jail cell. Despite everyone thinking they knew who did it, the murder of Charlotte Sowerwin turned into a cold case by the fall of 1988. And that brings us back to 1991 and the investigation of Kathy Young in Gunnison, Colorado. Knowing that Melanson was on the loose made Young nervous and desperate to charge him with a crime that would keep him behind bars, like the murder of Michelle Wallace. But in order to do that, she would need to find Michelle Wallace's body. Young looked into many different ways in which longtime missing victims had been found, and she wanted to try and apply them to this case. And that was how she came upon NecroSearch International and their efforts to find missing murder victims.
Okay.
Now, this is a volunteer organization that uses botany, geophysics, and entomology to help police unearth remains. So Young is going to ask for the organization's assistance. So that's pretty cool that they can do that.
That is pretty cool, actually.
So using the subalpine fir needles in the braid that had been found by the hiker in 1979, think about how good it is they found that braid.
I know.
They were able to confirm a specific north-facing slope that had an elevation of at least 9,000 feet. So when you take a look at the whole Schofield Pass to Keebler Pass area, because that's where the braid had been found, so they expanded the search, they matched that criteria with the map, which gave them smaller areas in which they had to search. So what Young did was she and the group of volunteers from the NecroSearch International created a search areas, and then they did a grid search to ensure that they would be able to search every inch of those areas.
I mean, that is pretty cool, right? I mean, talk about like big brain thinking and like, you know, getting everything together. Yes. It reminds me of, I'm sorry, guys, but it reminds me, because we've been watching it recently. But remember when in Stranger Things, when Bob is like trying to find Hopper?
Yeah, we're doing a rewatch before the new season comes out.
Yeah, but anyway, remember how he was like, you know, using coordinates and like figuring certain things out?
Bob was using science.
Yes,
and Bob was using science. Here. Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, I find that to be very fascinating.
It's very interesting, and it's a different way to approach the finding of a body. Now, of course, this can only happen in certain situations in which you have evidence that would be able to help you narrow down searches, but here we're having science help us solve cases.
Love it.
Very cool. But before we get into the search, what we're going to do is we're going to stop here and we're going to talk about our final sponsor of the show.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk. Still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, let's get back to the show. On the first day, nothing was found. But on the second day, one of the volunteers came across something that she at first believed to be a large mushroom, but instead turned out to be a skull.
Oh, no.
When the skull had a large gold tooth that had glimmered in the sun, it drew the volunteer's attention. this was a good sign because Michelle had a crown. Now, usually we're like, oh no, we're finding a body. But in this case, it's so good that they're finding Michelle's body.
Well, yeah, because I mean, at this point, we kind of figured, you know,
what happened.
Yeah, exactly. But at least we know that maybe the wish that her mother wanted can happen now if that it truly is her body.
Exactly. Now that they had found a skull, the team had a smaller area to search. Throughout the day, the team found several ribs and Michelle's hiking boots, with all the bones from her feet still inside. Slowly, over the next few days, all of Michelle Wallace's remains were uncovered. Kathy Young asked to be alone with those remains. And when she was, she made a promise to them, alone on the mountain, that Michelle had loved so much. She told the woman that she was going to get her justice and that she was going to bring her home. George Wallace was called immediately, the first day of the discovery, and he was told that he was finally going to be able to keep the promise that he had made to his wife.
I mean, that's as sad as that is, that I feel like that does bring a certain level of closure.
Right.
You know, a little bit. You know, I mean, I know it's, I mean, it doesn't really get better, but
It's a chapter that they can close.
Yeah.
Next, Kathy Young had to track Roy Melanson down. The last known address law enforcement had for him was the address that he had given when he was first released from prison, an address he had moved from long ago. When Young put his name into the system, she luckily found him easily.
Okay.
8 months prior, he had been sentenced to jail on a habitual burglary charge. And he was currently located at the Meade County Jail in Kentucky. Young arranged to meet him on April 13th, 1993. The date was chosen by Young specifically because it would have been Michelle's 43rd birthday.
Wow. Okay.
Young described Melanson as very polite, and she said he came across as a genuine person. But there was a point during the conversation that she said the hairs on the back of her neck stood up, because it was then that she realized, this is how he does it. This is how he puts you at ease. But he's a very dangerous man. Young confronted Melanson about Michelle Wallace, and he shrugged off the accusation, just as he had done in 1974. She told him that she had something to show him, and she revealed a picture of Michelle's braid. He had been unaware that this braid had been found because he was in prison when it had been. Finally, Melanson had been rattled, just as she intended him to be, and he ended the interview there. When Kathy Young got back to Colorado, she prepared an arrest warrant for Roy Melanson, 18 years after the murder he committed. He was brought to Colorado to face the murder charge. Melanson's defense thought that they were going to have an easy time proving that there was no evidence against him. However, the prosecution was well prepared. They had 39 witnesses, most of them experts. The trial ended on September 1st, 1993. It took the jury 5.5 hours to deliberate. Melanson was found guilty of murder in the first degree.
Good.
Now, when it comes to the sentencing, this is a unique situation. When you are sentenced, it has to be based on the laws that were written when and where the crime occurred. And we're talking about 1974. And in 1974, even if you were sentenced to life, you would be eligible for parole 10 years later. So that would mean that he would, whenever he starts his sentence. So Melanson still had to finish his burglary sentence in Kentucky. So he stays there until 2003. So that's another 10 years after he had been convicted of Michelle Wallace's murder. So it's once he finishes that sentence that he's then sent to Colorado to begin serving his sentence for the murder of Michelle Wallace, meaning that he would be eligible for parole in 2013. Once he was processed in Colorado, because This was for first-degree murder, very different than burglary. His DNA was processed and put into the CODIS system, which is a national database for criminal DNA. Young was confident that Melanson would not be paroled anytime soon because she thought there were other victims out there. And before it would get to 2013, there would be more matches. And she would eventually be proven correct. In 2009, 6 years into his sentence in Colorado, a match came back for a connection between Roy Melanson and another murder case from July 10th, 1974, in Napa Valley, California. This had been the brutal murder of Anita Andrews, committed just 50 days before the murder of Michelle Wallace.
I mean, this is wild. This guy was just on a rampage, and nothing ever seemed to slow him down.
No, nope.
You know, every
nothing
time
that, was sticking to him.
Yeah. I just find that so crazy when these things like that like happen.
Right. Anita was a single mother who was working two jobs. She had inherited a bar alongside her sister from their father. Napa in the 1970s was not the Napa of today. And the bar was located in a seedy area that the sisters knew was not the best. But it was better than giving up the legacy that their father had created. So they decided to run the establishment together, despite the fact that they both had other jobs. On the night of July 10th, Anita was bartending. Many witnesses said that around closing time, there was one patron who was hanging around and not going anywhere. Earlier in the night, other patrons had gotten into a fight with him. But this man had been the last one in the bar. The next morning, Anita's sister found her body in a pool of blood in the back of the bar. According to the medical examiner, the 51-year-old woman had been struck in the back of the head with what was most likely a bottle and then dragged into the back of the bar, where she was raped, stabbed 13 times with a screwdriver, and had her throat slashed. In addition to that, she had been savagely beaten. Her nose had been broken, and her face was badly bruised. Now, this sounds exactly like the attack that happened to Charlotte Sowerwin.
It does, actually. Yeah.
The DNA that had been collected from the bar was a cigarette butt that had been left in an ashtray, and there was also partial bloody fingerprints found near a staircase, as well as on a bottle that was most likely used to hit Anita in the head, and the open cash register. Many regular patrons would be considered suspects, but none of them could ever be tied to the murder because of their alibis. After 2 months, the case was considered cold. But luckily, the investigators at the time had preserved the cigarette correctly. And in 2009, when it was processed through CODIS, the match came back to Melanson.
I do love to hear that. I love it.
Kathy Young feared that victims like Anita Andrews could be everywhere because she now becomes obsessed with his case. And according to the information that she had gathered, throughout his transient life, this smooth talker, as he became known, Roy Melanson had lived in Kentucky, Louisiana, Texas, Colorado, California, Oregon, Montana, Nevada, Arizona, Mississippi, Illinois, Kansas, Georgia, Ohio, New York, Washington, New Hampshire, and New Mexico.
I mean, this guy could be this prolific serial killer that we just...
And rapist.
And rapist. And that we didn't even know, you know, that was connected to as many as he could possibly be connected to.
Yeah. Well,
what a rabbit hole to go down, though.
Yes, and she's right to go down this rabbit hole.
Oh, sure.
Because, you know, she was nervous, too, because we have a backlog of putting DNA into CODIS or processing old cold cases that have DNA. And sometimes they might not even be connected. So she made sure that Melanson's DNA was cross-checked with all cases in areas in which he had that had occurred that had his same MO during the time that he lived there.
That's smart. That's a good way to narrow things down. Yes.
And this allowed her to construct a timeline of terror that stretched 3 decades. Young found that wherever Melanson went, women were raped and brutally attacked, and sometimes murdered. Despite tying him to so many attacks, Young knew that there had to be others out there. Attacks that never had collected DNA, like if the police didn't process it correctly, or DNA wasn't found at the scene, or victims didn't report what happened to them out of fear. One of those crimes that he was suspected of was one of a landlord that had disappeared in Port Arthur, Texas. Now, this was Melanson's landlord, Pauline Klump. Her body had never been found, and the police always suspected Melanson, but could never prove it was him. No DNA was found at the scene. She was just missing one day. Her husband traveled for work, and she had been making food at the, gumbo at the oven.
Okay.
And when he got there, it was still on the stove, but they determined, it had been there for 6 days. So she'd been missing for 6 days. So they think he did that, but they just don't have anything to tie him to it.
Right. But, what are the odds that this guy was roaming around in that area?
Well, roaming that time? Around, that was his landlord.
Oh, that's true, actually. Yeah. So it's even a little closer to home here.
Right.
And all it would have taken was to her to maybe say something to him, and he snapped.
Right.
With her, because it's so close. But I do find that odd, though, that, you wouldn't want to do something that close to home.
Well, he was so cocky at this point because he's getting away with everything.
That's also true.
And whenever he would do something, he would just move. He had moved so many times.
Yeah, this guy's like a transient drifter.
But intelligent, which is scary.
True.
The other murder that was attributed to Melanson was that of Charlotte Sauerwin. Finally, it was connected to him through DNA through a sock found at the scene that was processed into CODIS in the spring of 2010.
Okay.
When Roy Melanson was questioned about all of these attacks, well, I just want to go back to that. Think about, Vince Lejeune had served a longer sentence than he did. His hometown turned against him and thought he was a murderer until 2010. It was proved he wasn't.
Well, it's almost like a double life sentence because not only do people think you did it, but you also lost your wife.
Right.
Right? So it's
devastating.
Yeah, it is.
Well, when Roy Melanson was questioned about all of these attacks and murders, he just smiled and told the investigators, "If you found my DNA, then go ahead and charge me." And that was all he said. Melanson was offered parole 10 years later, in 2013. But Kathy Young wrote a letter saying that when this man is released, he hurts and kills women. And she gave them her timeline. His parole was quickly denied because of the evidence she sent in. When Melanson died in prison in 2020, he was being investigated for 3 other murders. He was a terrible man that evaded capture for quite some time, but eventually he would have to pay for his crimes. And hopefully he had to pay in the afterlife for all the good that he robbed from this world through the light that he stole from all of his victims, those who survived and those who didn't. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, and well put, Kay. I mean, this guy is an animal, and I'm glad that he was never released once they had him in.
Once they got him, yeah.
Because, I mean, he was just going to keep going.
Yeah.
And honestly, I don't even care how old he is either. Like, they'll do it. If it's within them to physically get up out of bed, they'll do it. So it doesn't matter. You know, I'm sure that could be in some people's corner, like, oh, you know, he's old. He won't commit anything.
So much time out of jail that he should have died in prison.
Yeah.
Now, there's another really sad side story to this case.
Oh, God, don't do it.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to.
Okay.
Because I need to, report, because people will say, oh, you forgot this part of it.
I know.
Well, in 2006, so 3 years into him serving time for the murder of Michelle, So at least George Wallace got peace in that. George Wallace was at home in bed when two men broke into his home to rob him. When they found that he was home, now he was unable to get out of bed because he was using a wheelchair at this point because he's 85 years old. They beat him to death with a pipe.
What?
Yeah, in Chicago.
Oh.
This family knows nothing but tragedy.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Both he and Michelle were murdered, and Margaret died by suicide. So their son is all that remains.
That is so sad. Wow.
I know.
Wow. Okay.
We ended it on even a worse note.
That's heavy.
Yeah. The perpetrators at the time were 17 and 21. They both were caught and were given jail sentences for what they did.
Well, that's good at least.
Yeah. Crazy, right?
I mean, that is crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy how this guy denied that he was ever in her presence, Michelle's.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy at the bar is like, no, dude, you're in the car. Like, how about you get out?
Well, I mean, he has this cockiness in his life because look at everything he got away with. He was at the bar and had been into a fight with the people at the bar when he killed Anita Andrews that night. Didn't get caught. 50 days later, he does this to Michelle. Doesn't get caught. Then, as soon as he is released from prison in 1988, he does what he did to Charlotte Sowerwin the second he got out.
Yep.
And the dozens of rapes that he committed in between all of this were brutal. So this is a very dangerous man, and I'm glad that he got taken off the street, but I just feel terrible for the victims who are impacted for the rest of their lives and their families.
Yeah, there's a lot of devastation in his wake.
Yes. Okay. Well, before we leave, what we want to do is we want to say thank you to our new supporters on Patreon. We want to say thank you to Brianna Halpin, who upped her pledge, Ryan Fogarty, Melissa edited her pledge to a yearly membership, Michelle Holland, Carol Ann Ryan, Shamia Ali, Julie S., Kevin Kuntz, Shauna Dinsart, Elise Resende, Crystal, Stacy Gunkel, Ruby Ann Fenton, Lori Wood, Savannah, Suzanne DeFort, Courtney Madden, Emily Diaz, Trish, Hani Summer, Helen Graham, Mary Beth, and Melody Harrison. Thank you so much for joining Patreon, and we hope you're enjoying the extra episodes. If you want to join Patreon and get ad-free episodes and two full-length bonus episodes a month, you can go to patreon.com/truecrimecouple. But until next time, guys, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.